Yeah, exactly.
I make about a third of his salary. But
good. Thanks, Bob. It's good to be back here again. I'm going to talk today about a rather curious and elusive particle, the axion, and try to begin by developing a little intuition on the axion, because it's not the thing that it sort of defies intuition a little bit. It may solve one of the last remaining blemishes or problems in the standard model in the sector of the strong interaction. It may also provide a very nice solution to the dark matter problem. I'm not going to wax eloquent on that, because I think with Tony here, you've probably heard more about dark matter than you've ever wanted to. So let me. I'm actually going to talk not just about our experiment there, but other experiments looking for the axion, axions emitted from the sun, and also purely laboratory experiments as well. Okay, so I'll give some basics. I'll talk about the three experimental fronts going on, axions as the halo dark matter, searches for solar axions, and then purely laboratory experiments, and make some final remarks. In this last section here on purely laboratory experiments, you may be aware there's a very intriguing, a very curious result from a collaboration in Italy called the PB LAS collaboration, which has seen some very unusual properties, optical properties of the vacuum in a very strong magnetic field, which might be interpreted or could be interpreted as a light pseudoscalar. I think the smart money is not the axion, but it is an open question what in fact it is that they've seen. And I think you may have seen this in PhysRev letters and a lot of buzz about it in the past year. So about 10 years ago, our collaborator, Pierre Sacchivi, who's contributed so much to the field about experimental axion physics, he's a theorist at the University of Florida, wrote a very nice Physics Today article, which I would encourage you to go dig up and read, where he gives a kind of a fable kind of a metaphor about how the axion comes to be in the standard model. And it's a rather whimsical but very engaging story. And the story goes as the following. He said there's a gang of graduate students on Mars, physics graduate students, who like to play billiards. And they've ordered a pool table that was flown from on a rocket from planet Earth, and they've taken this mail order pool table, they've plunked it down on the Martian surface, and have at it, having a grand time playing pool. Now, one of these grad students here, which Pierre named as TSP, a thinking snookers player, is intrigued by something, and which has somehow eluded his colleagues, who are simply interested in playing billiards. Now, there's a heavy black cloth around the kind of a skirt around this pool table. He worries, why is it that you took a mail order pool table, and you plunked it down in some arbitrary location on the planet Mars, and when they play pool, the pool table is leveled to 1 part in 10 to the 11th, and you can play a perfectly fine, perfectly honest game of pool. They said, well, this is kind of odd, because the Martian surface, like any other planet, is hilly, it's modulated. There are two independent vectors here. There's obviously the normal to the surface of the local surface, but there's also the gravitational vector, which points towards the center of the Martian planet. He said there's no good reason why those two vectors should be the same. So he said, why is it that we bought a random, a mail order pool table, put it down in an arbitrary location, and the table was flat? He said, well, it could have been dumb luck, but maybe there was a dynamical reason why we ended up with a flat pool table. So he makes a hypothesis, and his hypothesis, he's a very good theorist, is that he said, if I were making pool tables and I wanted them to work in an arbitrary location, what I would do would be to put the pool table on a pivot or a fulcrum with a one-ton weight here and a very long pendulum, a very long lever arm to this thing. Then quite clearly, wherever I put the thing down, the thing will be in the upright position. He said, so I'm going to test my hypothesis. Remember, there's this black skirt around the outside, heavy curtain around the outside of the pool table, so we can't see it.
So what he does is this is kind of the paradigm of what experimental particle physicists do. He's going to take the billiard ball, whack it, and then hit the thing into the bumper like this. And he said, if my hypothesis is correct, when I whack the ball into the bumper, I might set up an oscillation, and then I will know that my hypothesis is correct. And this is exactly what experimental particle physicists do. You go to Fermilab, you go to CERN, you smash something very hard, and you try to promote quanta out of the vacuum. And an oscillation, in this case, he's trying to promote an oscillation out of the vacuum by smacking it very hard. Well, the experiment fails. But he doesn't get discouraged. He said, well, my hypothesis could still be correct about the pendulum. It's just that this thing is very, very long. He said, if this thing were a very long pendulum, then I would not expect to have an observable oscillation set up. So I could still be right. Then he has the critical insight. The critical insight is, he says, imagine this thing is on the rocket flying between the Earth and Mars, and for most of its journey, it's in a weightless environment. He said, now, in a weightless environment, think about how this thing would have been fixed into the cargo in the cargo hold of the rocket ship. He said, there's two vectors in the problem. There's the body axis of the ship, and then there's the axis of the fulcrum. So long as you're in a zero-gravity environment, the offset angle here has no physical meaning. It's arbitrary, has no physical manifestation. He said, but when you go to land the rocket ship and the pilot puts on the thrusters and it begins to slow down, in the frame of the rocket, you adiabatically begin to turn on the local gravitational field. And when the rocket comes to a rest, you're at the asymptotic gravitational field of the Martian surface. Once you start slowing down the rocket, if there's any misalignment angle between the body axis of the rocket ship and the pool table, then this has physical consequences, and then if I had a whole thing here, you'd get the idea. This thing would begin to relax down towards the bottom as kind of a damped driven oscillator. Okay, if the pilot comes down very slowly, then the thing will roll very quietly down, and you'll have very little remnant oscillation about the bottom. If the guy is a real cowboy, comes down with a bang, then in fact, an offset angle will imply a large remnant energy left in the oscillation. So then he says, aha, this is an experiment that every physicist knows how to do. It's a kind of a standard motif, which is to look for very weak signals by coupling them out through a high Q oscillator, tuned oscillator. And what I will do is either change the mass here or change the spring constant such that I tune the frequency. And if I tune across the frequency, even if there are these almost invisible oscillations, very, very minute oscillations left here, then if this is a high Q oscillator, when I hit the right frequency, all of a sudden I'll begin to see the energy couple out into a observable signal here in the spring mass combination. In fact, this is how he discovers the axion. And as you'll see a little bit later on, or he confirms his hypothesis is correct, this analogy tells us both about how the axion, where the axion sits in the theory, but also this motif here about looking for a very, very feeble oscillation by means of a high Q oscillator is going to be the strategy we use in our dark matter experiment. Okay, so then Pierre fast forwards, and he said, look, here in the strong CP problem, you have the QCD Lagrangian. You have one term here called the theta term, for which theta, this is the term speaking to gluons, this term here, theta, is an arbitrary phase angle. It can take on, it's an unprescribed angle. It can take on any particular value. For any value except one particular value, this thing would lead to a CP-violating effect. A CP-violating effect would mean that, in fact, the neutron would be allowed to have an electric dipole moment. We've known now for more than half a century, right from the first beautiful experiments of Ramsey and others, that, in fact, the neutron does not have an electric dipole moment, which means that, in fact, CP is a good quantum number in the strong interaction. And this is a big puzzle, because any number here of order of magnitude unity would have led to CP violating effects that would be 10 or 11 orders of magnitude better than the limit today, which is in fact about 10 to the minus 26. So in the late 70s, Helen Quinn, Roberto Pece, at young physicists at the time at Stanford, came up with a very nice mechanism, in brief, that in their mechanism, theta becomes a dynamical variable. At some very high temperature of the theory, the spontaneous symmetry breaking happens. Every point in space picks out its own value of theta. So far, so good. No physical manifestations of this. The only caveat being theta is continuously connected field. But in the lower energy limit of the theory, or if you think of this as the time from the Big Bang going out in time and cooling down, when you get to QCD time, about 100 nanoseconds after the Big Bang, you have non-perturbative potential here. You have a non-perturbative effect setting up a potential in this value of theta. All of a sudden, an offset angle in theta begins to have physical manifestations. Theta realizes that it's out of place and begins to roll down towards the CP conserving minimum in the field. And very quickly afterwards, independently, Weinberg and Wilczek said, my gosh, if these folks are right, then the remnant oscillations, this is a twofer, not only do you have a mechanism to drive theta to the CP preserving value, but the remnant oscillations about the minimum here is the axion field. It would be a physically manifest particle. So here's the Sakivi analogy. Here's the symmetry breaking scale in the Pece-Quinn mechanism, and here's the length of the pendulum in the Martian pool table. If I make the Martian pool table, the pendulum length longer, then in fact the frequency of the oscillation goes down. If I make the symmetry breaking scale higher, then in fact the mass goes down like 1 over F. Couplings, same thing. The longer the mass, it's more difficult for an impulse to couple energy into the table. Likewise, if the symmetry breaking scale goes up, all the couplings to matter, to radiation, whatever, also go down. Interestingly here, the total energy, and this is going to play an important role when we talk about dark matter, a longer pendulum for a given mass here, an offset angle corresponds to a linearly increased remnant energy of the oscillations. Likewise, and this is important in the role of axions in cosmology, the higher the symmetry breaking scale is, the more amount of axions were created in the early universe. And in fact, as we'll find out, at about a value of about a microelectron volt, axions would have closed the universe. Okay, just before we get on to some of the fun and games, which is the experimental sector, this is the phenomenology as we understand it right now. The mass of the axion goes down like 1 over this large unknown symmetry breaking scale. All couplings also go down like 1 over that. The axion is like a light pion coupled to two photons. You can think of it as like a cousin of the neutral pion. And then, as a consequence, you actually have at present day our understanding of the axion is a mass window that the axion can't be too light, because if it were much lighter than somewhere in the microelectron volt range, you would actually have axions overclosing the universe. We know we don't live in that situation. In fact, omega matter is actually not one. It's about a quarter. If the axions are too heavy, meaning also their couplings are too strong, they screw up the concordance of our modeling of stellar evolution and observation. And in fact, the most strict limit came from supernova 1987A. Which is where I think we're coming up on its 20th anniversary next month. Okay, so it was just 150,000 light years away. We saw bang, this huge supernova, and these two detectors. You got a prize for this, didn't you?
Right. Well, you can see the original plot.
Okay. They saw a total of about 20 neutrinos between the IMB detector and the Kamiokande detector in Japan, spread out over about 10 seconds or so.
Turns out, if you allow axions to be created in the interior of stars, if you make any mechanism, even if the axions are produced very rarely, they fly out of the core of the protoneutron star. They rob the thing of energy, and it completely screws up the time history. And in fact, it will quench the neutrino signal. So the strongest limit we have, the upper limit on mass, comes from your beloved supernova. Okay, so that's what we know about the axion.
So, how much is this model dependent, the two ends? I mean, well, there is no freedom in the model at all.
Not a lot. Jack can chime in here. There was a lot of discussion. There are more than what I described for you is what's called the vacuum relaxation mechanism for producing the axions. There's also topological strings which can produce axions. A number of years ago, they thought that they were producing wildly different numbers, where you would have gotten closure of the universe in axions for much heavier axions. As they refined these calculations and found mistakes, the thing drifted down such that they're not terribly different from one another. This thing here, the supernova limit, is probably not wrong to a factor of two. Georg Raffelt and others have made a cottage industry of understanding, of setting very strict limits on exotica, right-handed neutrinos, axions, all this kind of stuff, by what they do to stars, which are very sensitive thermostats. If you allow any odd behavior to take energy from a core of a burning star and leak out, if you have any sort of way of leaking energy out from the star, it does horrific things to its life cycle. In fact, it doesn't take, you know, if the axion coupling becomes too strong, stars wouldn't live more than 1,000 years. You know, because what happens is that you take out the energy and the thing actually heats up, because then gravity begins to compress the thing, because you're robbing the photon pressure, which normally keeps the mass of the sun out. And so if you leak energy out gravitationally, the thing begins to squeeze, heat up, burn faster, burns more, and the thing basically burns out quicker. So let me talk about the microwave cavity searches first, and we have an experiment going on at the laboratory. I'm going to be brief here because I think you already are well versed here in the whole concordance model. We now have a very good picture and a very crisp picture of the universe right now, by which we are small potatoes. Okay, so the ordinary baryonic matter is maybe 4%. What is truly luminous is just a fraction of a percent. About 3/4 is in the dark energy, and about 1/4 is in dark matter of unknown identity and believed to be in some particle remnant from the time of the Big Bang. A couple of very important models here, or a couple of hypotheses. One is that they might be in supersymmetric dark matter, the so-called WIMP. Most of the workers and most of the money in the world go here, and then there is the brave few here. Actually, just one or two groups in the world actually looking for axionic dark matter. One of them being our group down at the laboratory, and University of Washington, University of Florida. Let me skip over the whole issue of the evidence for the dark matter, because I think we want to get on to the experimental consequences here. People were in a very deep funk in the early 80s because people said, gee, the axion is a wonderful dark matter candidate. You know, it fits the bill. If the axion becomes lighter, omega axion goes up. At some point, you'll have as much of it as you want. You know, at the time they thought matter was 100% of the closure density. The problem, and it's cold, it was never in thermal equilibrium with everything. It was created in this phase transition and was never in thermal equilibrium. It was a zero temperature Bose gas. You couldn't hope for a better dark matter candidate. The problem was that the couplings are phenomenally weak. In fact, the only thing weaker is gravity. So in fact, roughly you can say that, you know, axions are as far below the weak interaction as the weak interaction is below the scattering of atoms. I mean, it's depressingly weakly interacting, and you could not conceive of a good particle physics experiment to see it. And then our colleague Pierre Sakivi had an absolutely brilliant idea here.
in this paper he wrote more than 20 years ago, he, you know, like Archimedes said, you know, give me a fulcrum, a lever, and, 500 million miles and I'll move the Earth. Sakivi said, give me three things. He said, give me a very strong solenoidal magnetic field, give me a high Q cavity made of very pure copper, and then give me a state-of-the-art microwave amplifier, and I will find the axion. Okay. And it relies on something called the Primakov effect, by which a pseudoscalar, an axion here, can, although it in principle can decay to two photons, it doesn't. The lifetime is unobservably long. An axion can be induced to convert into a single real photon. You can think of it as scattering from a sea of virtual photons in this Feynman diagram, and then a single real photon takes the full energy of the axion. So the axion converts into a single real photon in the presence of a sea of virtual photons, which is the magnetic field. And the whole thing is resonantly enhanced by a cavity, just like your car radio. And then you tune the cavity by means of metal and dielectric rods. And then you you cool all this down to get the blackbody radiation down. You get the very best state-of-the-art amplifier. And now you're looking for a relatively robust signal. Okay, signal is going to go like B squared V, Q of the cavity, things that you cannot control, the coupling, the mass, and the local density. And if you're lucky, the signal will be about 10 to the minus 23 watts. So we're talking trillions of watts. I guess that's 10 yoctowatts, I think. That's in the SI units there. Local density is about half of the dark matter, about roughly half of proton mass per cubic centimeter. At our point in the Milky Way, if axions are the dark matter and they're light, you're looking at a truly prodigious density, many trillions per cubic centimeter. On the other hand, it's a very odd Bose fluid because you've got this very dense cold fluid, but they're moving very slowly, and the de Broglie wavelength is very large. So you've got a very, very coherent Bose fluid. And so this was Sakivi's experiment. Right out of the gate, the people from Rochester, Brookhaven, and Fermilab and University of Florida were in a race. They both started making experiments about the size of a coffee can. This is a picture of the one that was fielded at Brookhaven. The cavity, we've still got a couple of them kicking around the lab, was about the size of a large thermos bottle. These two teams did a lot to develop the technology and all the pitfalls and learning about how you to do this experiment properly. And amazingly, and this is a tremendous tribute to these guys, in terms of the coupling constant squared proportional to the power out, they got within a factor of 100 or 1,000 of the model band here in mass versus coupling constant. It was quite impressive. I'll show you a little bit later on. This is the data that we've actually taken with our experiment at Livermore. So we started an R&D program in the late 80s, and then in the early 90s we were actually constructing, and then by 95, the end of 95, Thanksgiving of 95, we actually had an operating experiment and was operating routinely with good sensitivity starting in early 96. Here's the magnet. As you can see, it's a bigger affair there. That's about 11 or 12 ton magnet. The coil is at the very bottom. This thing here you should think of is sort of like a large thermos bottle. It's actually empty, and then the experimental insert actually just drops into the magnet. The coil is about 1.1 meters high. Central field of about 8.5 tesla, 85 kilogauss. Very, very strong field. It's about 14 megagauss stored energy. It's a lot of energy. About a 60 centimeter clear board. Very, very large superconducting magnet that we keep going day in, day out for literally years at a time. The Florida magnet, the first magnet that they actually procured one commercially, you could pick up with one hand. It was about 50 pounds. Okay. It was a much smaller affair. But it was about a 7 or 8 tesla magnet. There's the inside of the microwave cavity. Very shiny copper surface. Giving you the theoretically maximum Q. There's a metal rod and a dielectric rod. We've taken the lid off so you don't see the
the spindles and the gears there, but we can move these rods around reproducibly with step sizes of some, you know, somewhere between 10 and 100 nanometers to get sort of kilohertz type resolution. And there's the boys. This picture was taken years ago before safety standards got better. When I show this picture, lots of people in horror say, where's his safety harness there? So that's Edward Daw, who was Rosenberg's student with us and then went to work for LIGO and is now a professor at Sheffield. Chris Hogman still works at the lab. He's a he did one of the first two theses. He was the first PhD thesis out of Florida on this. And then Darren Kenyon, very brilliant kid, was my last student, finished up about 5 years ago. Actually, here. He was a UC Davis Department of Applied Science student. This is, you can actually see the can here, which is sort of a little vacuum shroud, which fits over the microwave cavity itself, and then there's the cryostat for the liquid helium for the experiment. That's what data looks like. It's noise. You spend year in, year out. You integrate for 100 seconds. You bump the frequency by a couple of kilohertz, integrate, and so forth. This span here represents the bandwidth, sort of the full width half maximum of the Lorentzian Q curve of the microwave cavity. The bandwidth is very tiny because the Q of the cavity is very good, sometimes a couple of hundred thousand or so. Once in a while, you something stirs the blood here. You actually see something that looks like an axion signal. So you go back and you analyze the data. Usually you're looking at the data some weeks after you take it. And you co-add the various traces. And lo and behold, you see something and say, my God, that looks like an axion. It's about 6 channels wide. That's about wide to about 1 part in 10 to the 6th. It looks like a little Maxwellian. Could that be the real article? And then you go back and you look at the subspectra, and then you say, very suspicious. It's not. It should be there all the time, and it isn't. In fact, it's most, it's strongest on the wings here. So this clearly looks like power that's leaked in through the weak diagnostic port, reflects off the cavity, and comes up through the amplifier chain. And then sometimes it goes away. Okay. In the, Mani, you were talking about the 100 megahertz range, but you know, this is right in the middle of the thickest part of the communication span. You've got radar, cellular phones, everything in the kitchen sink there. Everybody and his mother is using the 100 to 1,000 gigahertz range. This here looks much more like the real article. So you see the sum spectra, and you see this would be a very good threshold candidate. Has a certain width to about 1 part in 10 to the 6th. You go back and look at the subspectra, and you don't see any evidence there. This is the radiometer equation writ large. It's only when you co-add that the noise damps down, and what is the true signal begins to tease its way out of the background. You can say, well, is it an axion or not? How would you tell? We go back in our analysis.
What is the subspectra here?
We integrate for about 100 seconds and record the data. You're doing a fast Fourier transform. You're measuring a power spectrum of across the width of the bandwidth of your cavity, and then you bump the frequency ever so slightly so that you get overlapping, and then you do it again, you do it again, you do it again. Some weeks later, you'll actually do a second trolling, and then we'll normally, some weeks after that, do a third. So when all is said and done, each frequency will be contained in about 50 subspectra, which are these 100 second runs. Okay.
But your range is picked based on theoretical bias somewhere? Which frequency would you get?
Well, no, we have to go. We have a long march. We have to start at 10 to the minus 6 EV, which is about 250 megahertz.
Oh, I see.
Ideally, you want to go up to a milli EV, which is 250 gigahertz. And after all these years, we've only covered an octave down near the bottom. Now, I'm going to show you how we're speeding this up. We're about to speed this up dramatically. Remember, the prejudice is you want to start lower because omega axion goes up for lighter axions. So for heaven's sake, start at the left-hand side of it. And then if it's not there, keep on moving up.
See, why aren't the envelopes straight lines?
It turns out that sometimes the motion of the rod is not reproducible. We know what the frequency is, but the band you measure at
depends on the central frequency, and sometimes you don't take equal steps.
Oh, I see.
You do also see some funny remnant structure here, which has to do with the fact that you do take out of the electronics chain sort of a receiver transfer function. It's a very, it's a sort of complicated thing, like a radio. Now, the key thing here is we note the ones that go above threshold. You measure Maxwellian noise, you set a cut at the 95% confidence level, and then you go back later and on, and then you say of the million points you measured, 6,000 of them had fluctuations above this. Then we go back and look at each one of them, and then we drill in for like 20 minutes. And then if it's there a third time, then we have to look at them by hand. And then we have something that the WIMP people don't have. They would give their right arm to have, but they don't. We actually have a toggle switch on the dark matter. We can turn off the magnetic field. Okay. If you turn off the magnetic field, the signal has to go away. Even better, if you ramp the field up or down, it has to, the signal will go up and down like B squared. Okay, so we have the silver bullet to prove that the thing is an axionic dark matter. The WIMP people would, you know, Blas Cabrera and Bernard Satterlee would love to have a toggle switch on CDMS. They don't. Okay, they will never have a toggle switch. Okay. Yeah, I'll just skip over the details here of that. Anyway, the point is that this experiment did the job. By 1998, we published our first FISREV letter, and by gosh, we actually got down to one of the two sort of goalpost models that was sort of in the middle of the theoretical band that we had set to achieve. You can invert the analysis and sell the same paper to a different community that doesn't read Physical Review and publish essentially the same data in APJ. And say, by the way, if you assume you know what the particle physics model is, we can constrain the density of the halo. And they say, oh boy, that's terrific. We'd love to publish your paper. It's not quite that simple. But in fact, this is the way, the astrophysical way of looking at it. If you pick a particular particle physics model, in fact, we've constrained the halo exactly down to the best maximum likelihood estimate of the local density. Or you can say, if you know what the density is, what would you constrain in the way of a particle physics model? Let me pass over the issue of looking for fine structure and just talk a little bit about this issue that you raised, Mani, about speeding up the experiment. We were right from the beginning painfully aware of the fact that, you know, we were dealing with the very best technology that the government had invested billions and billions of dollars in, which were sort of these heterojunction field effect transistors, HFETs, popularly known as HEMT, high electron mobility transistors. Wonderful devices. They have at the very best, NRAO, who makes these amplifiers for the radio telescopes, and lots of other people who make them for communication satellites and all kinds of other military purposes and so forth, got these amplifiers down to 1.5 to 2.5 degree Kelvin noise temperature. But when you calculate the quantum limit, you're way, way, way above that. You have a long way to go. You have much room for improvement. In fact, the quantum limit here in the range of half a gigahertz is about 35 millikelvin. Okay. Sorry, H nu equals KT, Boltzmann constant, temperature equals H nu. We had a conference in Berkeley in the mid-90s, and we asked John Clark, very famous guy in the quantum device world, he's sort of the world expert on squids, to give a talk, and we said, well, you know, squids would be really wonderful. We know they don't work at high frequencies, so you can't make amplifiers out of them, but give us a talk anyway. So he gave us a wonderful pedagogical talk on squids, and he came up to us afterwards, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, if you can somehow beat out of NSF 100K a year, I promise I can. I think I know how to make a quantum limited high frequency amplifier for you. And we said, you bet, you got a deal. So we went and we talked to Tricia Rankin at that time, was spending time in NSF. She was the program monitor. A little bit of a difficult sell, but she finally got the point and sort of pulled the trigger on the whole deal. Funded Clark for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, not only he had given us much more than we had ever bargained for. He's made amplifiers which are now tunable. They match well to reactive loads. You can gang them together, you can stage them, and here's the key result. You cool the thing down with the dilution refrigerator, and the intrinsic noise of this amplifier on this plot is looks like it's about 50% above the quantum limit, which is absolutely stunning breakthrough in quantum electronics. This was big news, not just for our experiment, but lots of other people who use these things. Latest squids he's made now are actually within about 15% of the quantum limit. And my last student, Darren Kenyon, enterprising young fellow, now actually has gotten his own funding and is kind of parlaying his experience in designing. He sort of apprenticed himself to Clark and has built these amplifiers. He's now going around the world collaborating with people who are doing quantum computing, because a squid readout is exactly the kind of thing you need to look at reading out of qubit schemes, you know, single electron transistors or whatever you'd pick for a qubit. He can simply marry the squid to it as a basically a low noise readout. So these things could end up having a remarkable effect in the quantum information, quantum computing world. Let me skip over this, talk a little bit about this, and then talk about two other axion experiments going on.
So how does that speed you up? That just lowers your noise. I didn't catch that last part.
Yes, because remember the... let me go to this plot here. It will do two things. The power is the power, and that's only determined by the volume of the magnetic field and then what nature has dealt you in the way of the coupling constant. But remember, this is a signal-to-noise problem. You know, you're looking at a spectrum which is overwhelmingly noise, and you have to integrate, and then at some point, let me write the thing down. The Dickey's radiometer equation, 1946, I think it was in applied physics. The signal-to-noise is the signal over P noise. And then square root, let's see if I always get this thing right, of the integration time times the bandwidth. I can also write that as P signal over KT, the integration time over the bandwidth, like that. So the bandwidth is just set by the... By the intrinsic width of the axion signal. But this tells the whole story. Okay, so if you want to improve the signal to noise, you can either boost up the signal, i.e. get a bigger magnet, reduce the noise, or integrate longer. Integrating longer, sitting longer than 100 seconds at each frequency is not the way to go, because you've got to cover three decades in mass. So you can't dwell at any great length of time. The key thing you want to do is drive that down as far as possible. Okay, that will get you quicker to a detectable signal to noise, or put differently, for the same integration time, will allow you to cover the entire band of theoretical models. In fact, when the squids are fully implemented with the new refrigerator, we'll be down below the most pessimistic model and going faster by a factor of 5. That's what the role of noise performance in this. That's really the way to go. Okay, so brief summary. If you want to look for the axion, you should be looking somewhere in this mass range. As you can see, we've gotten off to a very slow start, but at least we're in the required sensitivity. But the nice thing is that you're dealing with a bounded parameter space, both in coupling and in mass. Ed Witten and others in the string community have sort of weighed in and taken an interest in axions right now. They like to find axions way down here at about 10 to the minus 9 EV or so. They find ways that the axion could be heavier, though they don't like it. The good news is that their coupling as a function of mass is not terribly different from these older phenomenological models. Okay, so phenomenological theories. So let me talk about... a search going on at CERN, very pretty experiment called CAST, the CERN Axion Solar Telescope. in the sun, we were talking about production of axions from the sun, you have in the solar burning core, you can actually have processes by which a photon will, again, this is a Primakov interaction, photon interact with a virtual photon to produce a pseudoscale like this, the axion can fly out of the sun without any further scattering. It would be a roughly Maxwellian spectrum with a mean energy of a little over 4 keV. Remember, the central solar temperature is much lower than that, but there are plasma screening effects which tend to suppress the low-energy part of the spectrum. The flux at the Earth is pretty high. If the axion were around an electron volt, although that's not a terribly favored place to find the axion, you'd be seeing on the order of about 10 to the 12th axions per square centimeter per second. The question is, can you see that? So, interesting, Sakivi does it again. In fact, in the same FISREV letter in 1983, it was kind of a twofer. Not only did he come up, pull out of the hat this beautiful experiment of the microwave cavity, he also said, well, imagine axions are produced by the sun. And he worked out the details of saying, look, if you had a dipole magnet, axion would fly through. It would be very relativistic, its energy being much higher than its mass, would convert into a photon, and then you would just detect an X-ray spectrum. And the X-ray spectrum would look exactly like what we looked at before. Dead simple way to calculate the conversion probability. It's just basically 1/4 the coupling constant, the strength and the length of the magnetic field squared, and then this form factor here, which is normally 1 for sufficiently light axions. There was Adrian Melusinos at Rochester who did the first cavity experiment, sort of beating the Florida people to the punch. Also, he did this thing. He read Sakivi's paper and read a paper that I wrote with a few other people shortly thereafter on sort of really how to do this experiment properly. And he just set up an old warm dipole magnet on the floor at Brookhaven. And it was in a closed building, and they sort of, you know, kind of looked out the window and said, yeah, where do you think the sun is going to come down? They kind of shimmied the thing around, put up an X-ray detector, went for coffee, the sun set for the night, came back, looked at the spectrum, and published a FISREV letter. So he was, you know, he was, they never let grass grow under their feet. The Tokyo people a few years later did a much better job. They actually designed and had Toshiba build them a dry superconducting magnet and put it on a gun mount, such that this thing could actually follow the sun 24 hours a day. Very, very nice experiment, still going on in the basement at Tokyo University. And then the CERN people did it right. You know, it's nice being in a rich lab. So they actually took a prototype dipole magnet from the LHC, and they put it on a mount here, which is reminiscent of like William Herschel's telescopes from the late 1700s. You know, they kind of dragged the tube around on some kind of A-frame or something. But the thing is really a very precision experiment. They've actually demonstrated that they can track the sun. So you've got the bore of the magnet that's about this, you know, probably the cross-section of an egg or something like this, 10 meters long, that this thing can actually, the software and the motor control actually tracks looking at the sun perfectly. And every few months they check it. They just took a welding torch, cut a hole through the side of the building, and from time to time they actually look at where the sun is, and it's just fine. Okay, big magnet. It's about nine Tesla, about 10 meters long. And they take data a few hours in the morning and a few hours at nighttime, of which they actually get about 1.5 hours when they're actually looking right on and not doing a background run. 1.5 hours at dawn and 1.5 hours at dusk. So they have detectors up here which are looking at the sun as the sun is coming up, and then it's actually nice. The students only take shifts for 4 hours a day. It's really good. You know, so and then when the sun is going down, the thing is moving like this, and then you have two detectors over here which are looking for axions conversion going this way. Remarkably, they are... have just published about a year ago and are just getting ready to publish a little bit better data, which is competitive with the limits you get from horizontal branch stars here. So again, you can do the old business looking at red giants and say, well, if axions existed, how would it screw up how long they lived in the red giant phase, and you know, do axions suppress the helium flash and all this kind of business. You can play this game to get up relatively strong limits. Their direct non-observation of axions coming from the sun competes with that, and in fact the paper that's in preprint form right now will actually do slightly better than that. And again, in a region where probably the axion has already been excluded, but it's very good to check anyway. Here's the band of axion models. They are now doing implementing a little trick I published some years ago, which allows them to extend the mass range up higher in mass, where normally this experiment wouldn't work, because for sufficiently heavy axions, the axion is no longer fully relativistic, so as the axion state rolls into the photon state, the wavefronts get out of phase. And it turns out you can restore the coherence of the conversion process just by filling the bore of the magnet with a dilute gas and then tuning the gas pressure. Okay, so when the plasma frequency equals the effective mass of the photon, then you can restore, you can sort of tune frequency by frequency and then push the sensitivity of this experiment up into the model band. It's not completely a senseless idea to do this experiment, but because between the supernova 1987A limit and the horizontal branch star limit, there may be a slight non-closure in this region that should be patched up by doing a direct search with the CAST experiment. So in the last 10 minutes or so, I want to talk about purely laboratory experiments.
I just had a question on that last bunch. Your experiments that you were talking about in the superconducting cavity are actually setting limits down lower, right?
They're setting limits down here with an assumption that the axions are the dark matter.
Right.
Now, that's not an independent assumption, because for a sufficiently light axion, you couldn't help but for the axion to have been produced a lot during the time of the Big Bang. But remember, we cover mass ranges sequentially. We're not able to do a broadband search. So we've only covered on this plot, I'll show you a better plot later, we've covered from here to here in a notch. Did that answer your...
Yeah.
Okay. So, you might say, well, gee, you know, assumptions about the dark matter or assumptions about the sun's burning core, or these very complicated experiments, couldn't you just do this thing in a laboratory without resorting to sort of cosmological or astrophysical assumptions? And the answer is you can't, and it's dead simple. In fact, I've been in this business about 20 years now. My debut into this, I was thinking about this, and I actually published this very simple FISREV letter, and a number of my friends around the world sort of said, oh my God, they sort of slapped their head and said, what an obviously simple idea. It turns out it doesn't allow you to set a very strong limit, but you can simply take a laser, shine a laser through a high energy physics dipole magnet, produce axions, you build a brick wall, the axions will convert back into photons, and you look for the photons with a PMT. Okay. It's kind of like a beam dump experiment, but prettier. Okay, it's a beam dump experiment done with lasers and magnets. The conversion probability is just this and this are identical, so it's just the square of the probability of converting a photon into an axion, and it's the same as the axion going back to a photon. So it's 1/16, the coupling BL times to the fourth power, like that. Again, one of Adrian's people beat us to the punch, probably the same magnet, you know, just take off the... actually, they use the old CBA dipole magnets, the old Isabel magnets, two superconducting magnets, about 5 meters long, about 3 or 4 tesla, put up a laser, and were able to set a weak limit, which had already been excluded by stellar arguments, but I think it was a very, very cute result. The reason why this is not very good is obvious, is that you pay 2 powers of G here and 2 powers of G there. So this is an experiment that is hard to improve dramatically. We're just now, actually, Pierre Sakivi, Dave Tanner, and I just today submitted a FISREV letter that showed you can actually boost this experiment by about 10 or 12 orders of magnitude by just putting up a Fabre-Perot interferometer, or Fabre-Perot cavities here, sort of frequency, locked in frequency, and you can actually get a resonant conversion, which
allows you to improve the coupling constant by a factor of about three orders of magnitude or so. Experiment that Luciano Maiani, Mimmo Sabatini, who just passed away just a week or two ago or so, and Roberto Petronzio published, and then was again done at Brookhaven and more recently by the Italians, actually can search for axions in the following way. You take a laser, shoot it through a dipole magnet, and you put up a Fabre-Perot here. And when you think about it, if you take if the axis of the magnetic field is like this, remember it's an E dot B interaction, if you launch your laser beam down the magnet at about a 45 degree angle, there's a couple of interesting things that can happen. One is that given that the production of axions goes like E dot B, if I think of decomposing the electric field vector into longitudinal and perpendicular parts with respect to the B field axis, the photons polarized parallel to the magnetic field can produce axions, whereas this component cannot. So this one produces axions, this one doesn't. So what happens is that very small number, very small fraction of these axions will actually bleach out, and so E parallel will get shorter, E perpendicular will stay the same. What will happen is that there will be a very slight rotation of the axis, and so there's what they call a vacuum by refringence. The effect is very small, and therefore they said you should do this in a Fabre-Perot cavity, such that you get equivalently 50 or 100,000 bounces back and forth here to build up the signal. But this is effectively what you're looking for. You launch in the laser light, and then look for this very small rotation about the axis. You can also look for, that's a vacuum dichroism. You can also look for birefringence by virtue of the fact that not only QED, but also axions, virtual axions here, will give you a different index of refraction, vacuum index of refraction, n perp, which is different from n parallel as well. So linearly polarized light will become slightly elliptically polarized. And of course, the effects are very, very tiny. Now, odd thing here. They saw nothing. They published null results in about 1990 or so. One of their students, one of their postdocs at the time, Giovanni Cantatore and Mimmo Sabatini, said, look, this was very good, but we think we know how to do this experiment better. They went back and spent many years designing and building an upgraded version of this experiment at Lignaro. And they built a superconducting persistent magnet. So you charge up the magnet, you disconnect the leads, and you have a persistent magnetic field here in this magnet. And the thing sits on a turntable and rotates at about a half a hertz like this. So they keep the optical path fixed. They don't try to wiggle or wobble or change the rotation of the light. They keep the optical path fixed and then spin the magnet vertically around the optical path. Sounds kind of hard. Here was the exclusion limit. Here's where the axion and photon begin to get out of phase for a sufficiently heavier axion. This was the Yannis Amrazidis and others from the Rochester Brookhaven Fermi Lab, Triastic collaboration from 17 years ago. The Italian group, after many years, had been seeing a signal, were not able to make it go away, and finally decided to sort of come clean in FizRev letters. And so they published last year this quite remarkable result where they actually saw a positive signal here. So this is no magnetic field, and this is with magnetic field. And sure enough, they actually saw a signal at this 2 omega harmonic. Now, they use a electro-optic modulator to turn linearly polarized light into elliptically polarized at about 500 hertz to push it away from DC. And then there will be additional sidebands by virtue of the fact that the magnet is spinning at a half a hertz rate. So the fact that it's a 2 omega is the telling thing, because
if this is the axis of the electric field of the laser, the magnet, the dipole magnet, is actually in the correct E dot B orientation every 180 degrees. It doesn't make any difference which way the B field changes. So you, the signal you're looking for a true effect would be at 2 omega. And by gosh, they saw it, and it would be consistent with the production of a light pseudoscalar of about 1 to 1.5 millielectron volts at a rather shockingly strong value of the axion photon coupling, or the pseudoscalar photon coupling.
What's the horizontal frequency axis?
This horizontal frequency?
Yeah.
This is...
Can't read the numbers.
506. This is about 500 hertz, because what they do to get this thing away from DC is that they actually do modulate the light from linear to elliptical
with that.
And so that's pushed out. So you would see this signal here, even if the magnetic field is off. Then when you turn on the magnetic field and the thing is spinning, you're looking for a sidebar here at 2 omega. Okay, now.
Can they change the spinning rate and see this separate or something?
Yes, they've done oodles of things over years, and they were honestly trying to make the signal go away, and they couldn't. Okay. Now, there are lots of difficulties with this experiment, and there's lots of things which are peculiar about it. One of it is the fact that their experiment was not so much more sensitive than the other ones, and they actually found a positive signal just at the sort of the tip of the fingers of where these other guys didn't see an effect. Also problematic is the fact that you see this 1 omega peak, which in fact shouldn't be there at all. Okay. And they also see, problematically, around the axis where they when one would see a signal. Here they change the quarter wave plate by 90 degrees such that, and this is a, it's basically you can actually measure the phase of the signal, which would actually reverse the phase of the signal. And it does, but the problem is that each run takes, I think, about 15 minutes or so, actually has large walking around or large variations. You don't see all the data lie up here and then at a point like down here. There's the scatter to this data, which is much bigger than their stated results. Kind of suspicious. They also see effects having to do with the dichroism of gases, which you're not supposed to. You can see the Cotton-Lutone effect. You can see birefringence from gases. You're not supposed to see a dichroic effect from gases. So the community looking at this says, look, this is intriguing, but very odd. And I think a lot of people are not quite that charitable. But they were hoping to see the QED effect, the ordinary light-by-light de-scattering, but fell short by many orders of magnitude. But then, like a rabbit coming out of a hat, they saw this thing, which was quite odd. The first thing that's odd about it is that, in fact, where they found the signal should have been buried already by four orders of magnitude by cast in the horizontal branch star limit. Okay, that already should give you pause for concern. As I mentioned, it was just at the fringe of the exclusion region of an early experiment that was done, which was a very rather carefully done experiment. Appreciate the fact that the signal is very small. If you just look at this from the point of view of a single pass through the magnet, the dichroic effect, the vacuum dichroism, the little tipping of the angle, just due to the bleaching out of the longitudinally polarized photons into axions, if you just go on the back of an envelope, it's equivalent to the thickness of a pencil lead from here to the moon. Now, the signal they measure is bigger because when the Fabry-Perot, it makes about 50,000 bounces. But even so, it's a pencil lead across the city. It's still a very tiny effect, and lots of things can go wrong. Systematic issues that I talked about, and the fact that they do see dichroism with gases at low pressure. There are problems which have never been quite sorted out. It turns out even if you have stray fields to the tune of even a microgauss hitting your optics can become birefringent. I mean, lots of screwy things can happen when stray magnetic fields, even at a trivial level, start hitting transparent media. I'm very suspicious of the fact that you have this laser beam, which has a very finite width, a sort of a Bessel-like fall-off, inside of a quartz tube that's 2 centimeters in diameter,
and the Fabre-Perot is 7 meters top to bottom. And any scraping of that beam hitting the quartz tube, and the quartz tube is right in the middle of the magnetic field, can have a horrifically large optical activity to it. And that will basically contaminate the entire cross-section of the beam because the beam diffracts and bounces back so many times. Nevertheless, this has had a salutary effect, and it's launched about half a dozen polarization rotation experiments going on around the world. The first one that seems to have beaten everyone to the punch is being done at Jefferson Lab with their free electron laser. They did a pilot run before Christmas, and I think they're taking their real data run right now. Okay, so I'm a little over, so let me just sort of cut to the chase here. This is the kind of the curtain call of all the axion limits and going on in the world. So here's the theoretical band, and as I mentioned, both the mass and the couplings go like 1 over the symmetry ranking scale, so the mass goes proportional to the couplings. This KSVZ model here sits right in the middle of the band, DFSZ, which was the other goalpost that we chose to design our experiment, is at the bottom. But the real band, if you do a exploration of many kinds of models, is about twice that width. And the cavity microwave experiments we're doing actually are right down in there, and with these new quantum limited squid amplifiers will allow us eventually to go down below the bottom and to troll faster up through what we believe to be the allowed mass range. We're doing the upgrade. DOE has funded the upgrade for the past 2 years. We're within a couple of months of finishing. We should be commissioning and running with the upgrade sometime this summer. CAST is now doing better, demonstrably better than the horizontal branch star limits, and will do a measurable service here by cleaning up this potential lack of closure here in the range of about 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the 0 to 1 electron volt range there where it crosses the model region. And then you've got this very odd thing of the vacuum birefringence and vacuum dichroism result here, which I think very quickly we're going to, even though one might just look at the face of it and say, look, this thing is obviously wrong because it's such striking variance with the CAST and the stellar revolution limits, but there are now direct experiments of photon regeneration experiments which are basically going to exclude that, I think, rather quickly.
You can do that, Maastricht? With TV lenses?
We?
Yeah.
With our experiment? Anything up here, for a sufficiently heavy axion, axions would be thermally produced rather than being produced by this vacuum relaxation mechanism. And as you go up in mass, the fraction of the universe that would be in axions goes down. So in fact, the presumption of our experiment is that the axion is the dark matter. Anything up a sufficiently heavy axion would be exceedingly unlikely to be dark matter. However, these other experiments are operating right as we speak, are actually going to go back and check this themselves. I think fundamentally there's an artifact that they're going to find in this thing, because it's just a very difficult experiment to do. Final observations here. The Frank Wilczek digs at his heels about the axion, and he's sort of our bodyguard. And his basically comment is, look, if the axion doesn't exist, please tell me how to solve the strong CP problem. You know, so he sort of throws down the gauntlet. Recently...
But it doesn't have to be the dark matter.
That's correct. He would be very happy if he found an axion and weren't the dark matter. He'd probably be a little happier if he found the axion and also did double duty and was the dark matter. Axions may be intrinsic to the structure of string theory. As I said, all of a sudden this has gotten on the radar screen at for the string people, and they just had a large workshop there in November or so back at the institute there. The experiments are hard, very hard, but they're making great progress, and their discovery would teach us a lot. I didn't talk a lot about the fact that axions if they are the dark matter, could very well have fine structure to them. And fine structure, just due to late infall axions, since this experiment measures the total energy of the axionic signal, the mass plus the kinetic energy, actually sees this little Maxwellian, this narrow Maxwellian, and there may even be fine lines on top of that. And those lines will Doppler shift from minute to minute just due to the Earth spinning on its axis, and then as a course of weeks and months as the Earth goes around the Sun. You could actually see these lines. We've done simulations if you take some kind of infall model with or without angular momentum, and you see these infall lines dance around out of phase, go up and down in amplitude, and so forth. So it would be like being given sort of a video of the galactic infall, the recent galactic infall, which would teach us a lot. It would be real cool, they've done this for neutrinos, but it would be real cool to see an image of the nuclear burning core with solar axions. I don't think it would teach us the central temperature better than it already been learned by lots of other ways, but it would give us a very nice direct picture, unblurred picture of the nuclear burning core. If you saw them in the axions, if you saw axions in the laboratory at some very strong coupling constant, you would have changed physics in sort of imponderable ways, which I don't want to think about. They have their challenges. The cavity, interestingly, with the squid amplifiers, we're the one dark matter experiment where sensitivity is not an issue, but trolling up in mass and putting in new cavities and all that is where the hard work is. The helioscope, I can't imagine they're going to get much better than the stellar evolution limits, but I think it's a good thing to finish. And then the lab experiments, they're independent of astrophysics and cosmology, but the limits you set are weak, and we've learned ways of making them somewhat better, but in fact even better than the horizontal branch star limit, but again are going to be very, very difficult. But one of my colleagues used to say, remember, physics is where you find it. So with that, I'll stop.
Yeah, I bet there are lots of questions out there.
No.
Good question. So, presumably this is truly cold.
Yes.
Axion, so that they could cluster with time on arbitrarily small scales. Is that right? Or are there no gravitational effects at all?
That's a good question. So you're saying if you wait long enough, you should actually see clustering down to the smallest scales.
Right.
Let's see.
Don't they have to interact?
No, just gravitationally.
They're very light, though. I don't know if anybody...
But if they're non-relativistic,
right. Yeah, they could. Now, of course, they come in if there's pre-existing large gravitational potentials, like our own galaxy plus its halo. They'll come falling over the edge, like, you know, down a ski slope, and they will scatter off stuff and get kind of stirred up gravitationally. If you have some small perturbation, I think the answer to that is correct, and I'd like to know what the n-body simulations would say if you took a truly cold fluid.
Well, there's a problem in that field right now, and that is the generic cold dark matter clusters too much compared to observation.
Okay.
By a large factor. So there's a lot of attempts to make it warm.
So you're saying if at zero temperature, the simulations cluster too much? Or you said the. Yeah.
Just ordinary generic cool dark matter simulations already clusters too much.
Is that independent?
Is that independent of all I would be on your side. The reason I bring this up is I've heard people basically, you know, shifting back and forth all over the place since a few years ago when it became a big issue, and then somehow then they came and said, no, and then I now again hear
the
rise
of
the...
There's the theoretical predictions, which I think
are... No, I know.
They should be clustering on small scales.
Yes, I know, but I also know that many of these people are still not agreeing with each other.
If neutrinos can oscillate, so can people. So do you.
Is it more than just the cusp problem?
It's
the
cusp.
Simply the cusp.
But it occurs on many scales all the way from galaxies to cusps.
Okay. Yeah,
it's called the overmerging problem.
Yeah.
See, how sensitive are the mass limits? Suppose there was another galactic supernova and you could measure the neutrinos in that supernova infinitely well, instead of with a dozen events, 10,000 events.
Yeah, we would.
Is it simply statistics that was the limiting factor?
Yes, actually, if you had a nearby supernova that did not do us harm, I would pay for that. Yeah, if you're actually able to detect in a large detector hundreds of thousands of neutrinos, you would get much crisper limits on the supernova. Or you might see evidence for the first time that axions are flowing out, and they might interact in the. It has not escaped attention that the and you can speak better to this, that the overlay of the IMB and the Kamiokande is very unsatisfactory.
Right.
It doesn't look good. It doesn't look like anything that you would spew out of a Monte Carlo code the way these neutrinos interacted in terms of their distribution and angular distribution in the water. And it's a big puzzle.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a thermal spectrum.
Right. But yeah, sure, we'd love to have another supernova.
I was just going back to, you know, when in the very beginning you talked about the coherence level of these, of the axion flux.
Yes.
You said some numbers, I think 100 meters or kilometers. How strongly does that, that can be known that well, so...
No, this is simply...
You also said six count wide or something.
The second statement is simply the assumption that we know what the local virial velocity is. And we channelized the spectrum such that it doesn't show up as one peak, but it actually has a few. We would see a signal, whether it was 3 or whether it was 10 or whatever, on our filters. You know, we've done all kinds of filtering techniques as we troll through our data such that we could see things of different width. The coherence length is a different issue. The only thing one requires for this experiment is that that the coherence length of the axions be larger than the diameter of the cavity. But that's really just an issue of, here's your noise spectrum, and then you've got this Maxwellian peak like that, and this is narrowed to 1 part in 10 to the 6th. Delta E over E, or delta omega over omega, that's just taking the momentum uncertainty of this and just using the uncertainty principle. If there's now, as Pierre and others say, that there might be these fine structure lines here out here, the coherence length of these things could be thousands of kilometers. And the experiment, one of the things I would love to do if you ever saw the axion is that you would take, of course, the first thing when you do the axion is it becomes a junior lab experiment. It doesn't cost millions of dollars anymore. You can really just do it with rather primitive experiments because you sit right at the frequency, and now you have the luxury of just integrating as long as you want. You can go to another class, come back, and then the thing will sort of tease its way up above this thing. But you could imagine taking two of these things and then phase combining them, putting one of them on a railroad track, and then just doing the experiment as a function of separation for the thermalized, the gravitationally thermalized spectrum here, what you would see is that you would measure a correlation function that would fall off in the usual way with some characteristic distance of the size of a football field. These things... because these things could be narrow, and our fine structure, we actually have a fine structure channel. We actually have one channel by which you measure the fast Fourier transform for a full 50 seconds. So you're actually then measuring, you're actually able to measure things down to like 0.01 hertz, or 1 part in 10 to the 11 of the overall frequency. This thing would be immeasurably long. But like people who do radio telescope work, they actually just stream record their stuff between Australia and Jabiru Bank, and they're measuring a coherent
photon wave over the diameter of the Earth. And, you know, if you could do that experiment here, you would see the same thing for the fine structure. It's a very interesting Bose system.
I'm just curious, is the Primakov effect a sure thing for the detection?
Oh, yes. I'll tell you the story. This is very interesting. The history of the Primakov effect is fascinating. It's old-time high-energy physics. The old time, well, there are no old timers here, Okay, so the story goes as the following. In the early the 40s and 50s, when they discovered, you know, pions, they discovered that there was this thing called the neutral pion, and they wanted to measure its lifetime. And it turns out they couldn't very well. They would take nuclear emulsions, and they would shoot in proton beams, and then you would see a blast of stuff coming up. This is real old-fashioned stuff, you know. And then ever so often, if you look under a microscope, you would see a one part time in 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, instead of the pion going to photon-photon, it would go to electron-electron, okay, electron-positron. And you would see a very tiny gap, and you would see a Dollitz pair there, okay, and or electron-positron pair. And they would try to measure this thing, saying they'd make assumptions for what gamma tau was for this thing, and they would measure this thing and say, well, it looks like half a micron, micron and a half, and they had piddling few statistics, and they got some estimate that it was 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to the minus 17 seconds. Terrible way to measure neutral pion lifetime, because most of the time it doesn't even decay this way anyway. I think it's 10 to the minus 3 branching ratio or something. Henry Primakov cracked the problem. He said, aha, I have the right insight here. He said, I don't need to measure a decay flight pattern here. All I need to do is measure a cross-section. He said, if I shine photons onto a high Z nucleus, gold or uranium, I'll take a GeV gamma beam. A high Z nucleus you can model as basically a classical electromagnetic field. So you can actually take a point high Z source and mathematically you can actually decompose this thing as a virtual photon spectrum. And he said, now I can look at the fusion of a real photon with a virtual photon from what's effectively a classical electromagnetic target, look at the pion, and then watch the thing decay downstream in a hotoscope. And he said, now I don't have to measure the lifetime. All I have to do is measure the cross-section. Why? Because the same cross-section, the same coupling constant, G pi gamma gamma, determines both this cross-section, and it also determines how quickly it falls apart. Okay, so if you measure the cross-section, you've synonymously measured the lifetime without having to use a clock. And of course, it's correct to, you can measure it very, very accurately. So this was this was called the Primakov effect. But this is well known, the issue of the fact that you can have a virtual and a real photon. This is the basis of all kinds of two photon physics that you guys did, I think. And in the
Dick convinced me. We did the inverse direct photon at Fermilab.
Yeah.
Where this photon was produced, and you look for the inverse parasitic production.
Okay, yeah, sure. So it's old hat from a particle physics point of view.
So my question is, if the axion interacts at all, it has to do this.
Yes.
Otherwise,
right. The more general question about its couplings is that it has to have couplings to quarks. It has to have couplings to gluons. It may or may not have couplings to leptons, but it has induced couplings to photons that you can't escape. They might be more or less, but remarkably, when some people have actually pulled numbers out of the air and tried to do studies about how much the axion photon coupling could be, remarkably they group up for reasons, maybe accidental or not, but you don't seem to find large excursions from that band I showed. Maybe Jack could speak more to this, but.
Okay. More about this,
but, old science. Yeah.
What about the limits on axion from invisible decays of things? I mean, Why is it? That should be well known too.
Like from collider experiments.
It seems like it's the lightest thing, so it should affect all branching ratios somehow.
If you look at kind of the seamless garment, let's see if I can back up here. Here I'm only showing the lowest, and I should have put all these limits on here. But remember the history of the axion is that Pecha and Quinn, for no good reason whatever, said, well, the symmetry Rankine scale, what could it be? He says, where's the last time we know physics happens? Well, the electroweak scale, so 250 GeV. That would have given you an axion that would have been 100 keV or an MeV heavy. So it would be pretty heavy. So it would be way up here. There, all of a sudden, people jumped in and very quickly started looking at reactor experiments, collider experiments, nuclear decays, and they didn't find it. What happens is that very quickly, since the coupling constant, the generic feature of the axion is that the mass and the coupling are locked like this. All of a sudden, you get down to the point where the cross-section is just too abysmal for any laboratory counting experiment to work. Then, all of a sudden, people realize, well, you can play games by considering what happens if they're created even rarely in stars, which are these delicately balanced, you know, they're kind of, you know, governors. And you all of a sudden allow a channel for a sort of a direct flight or sort of a direct way of leaking energy out of the center of a star, and how does that screw up the concordance of the observations in the model. Down here, you're just way beyond that, and the genius of Pierre Sachievi is that he realized that through the axion-photon coupling, you can make up for this very poor coupling constant by looking at the coherent rolling of the axion state, the coherent axion photons mixing over large spatial regions, which allows you to make up for that with, you know, large volumes and modern superconducting magnets. That's sort of the common thread of these experiments, is the fact that you're looking for this axion photon mixing in a large magnetic field over large regions of space, because you're way, 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 way down below where traditional nuclear physics modalities work. For this,
I think we better call it quits, and people will stop questions when we come up. And I think we'll go out and have a cup of coffee and probably go to dinner if people are interested. So let's thank Carl for a great time. See you.